Like this war, Bhutan said. Jane Sagan edged closer to the eighth and final gun emplacement. Like the others, it tracked her and then warned her the closer she got to it. As near as she could tell, if she got closer than about 3 meters, the gun would fire. Sagan picked up a rock and threw it directly at the gun. The rock struck and bounced off harmlessly, the gun's systems tracking but otherwise ignoring the projectile. The gun could differentiate between a rock and a human. That's some fine engineering, Sagan thought, not very charitably. She found a larger rock, stepped up to the edge of the safe zone, and chucked it to the right of the gun. It tracked the rock. Farther to her right, another gun trained on her. The guns shared targeting information. She wasn't going to get past them by distracting one of them. The bowl they were in was shallow enough that Sagan could see over the lip. As far as she could see, there weren't any open soldiers in the area. Either they were hiding or they were confident the humans weren't going anywhere.
Yes!
Sagan turned and saw Daniel Harvey coming toward her with something squirmy in his hand.
Look who's got dinner, he said.
What is that? Sagan asked.
The hell if I know, Harvey said. I saw it slithering out of the ground and caught it before it went back in. Put up a fight, though. I had to grab its head to keep it from biting me. I figure we can eat it.
By this time, Seaborg had limped over to look at the creature.
I'm not eating that, he said.
Fine, Harvey said. You starve. The lieutenant and I will eat it.
We can't eat it, Sagan said. The animals here aren't compatible with our food needs. You might as well eat rocks. Harvey looked at Sagan as if she had just taken a dump on his head.
Fine, he said,
and bent down to let the thing go. Wait, Sagan said. I want you to throw that.
What?
Harvey said. Throw that thing at the gun, Sagan said. I want to see what the guns will do to something living.
Well, that's kind of cruel, Harvey said.
A minute ago you were thinking about eating the damn thing, Seaborg said.
Now you're worried about cruelty to animals?
Shut up, Harvey said.
He cocked his arm back to throw the animal.
Harvey, Sagan said, don't throw it directly at the gun, please.
Harvey suddenly realized that the trajectory of the projectiles would lead directly back to his body.
Sorry, he said. Stupid of me.
Throw it up, Sagan said. Way up. Harvey shrugged and launched the thing high into the air in an arc that took the thing away from the three of them. The creature writhed in midair. The gun tracked the creature as far up as it could, roughly 50 degrees up. It rotated and shot the thing apart as soon as it came back into its range, shredding it with a spray of thin needles that expanded on contact with the poor creature's flesh. In less than a second, there was nothing left of the thing but mist and a few chunks falling to the ground.
Very nice, Harvey said. Now we know the guns really work. And I'm still hungry.
That's very interesting, Sagan said.
Well, then I'm hungry, Harvey said.
No, Harvey, Sagan said, irritated. I don't actually give a damn about your stomach right now. What's interesting is that the guns can only target up to a certain angle. They're ground suppression.
So?
Harvey said.
We're on the ground.
Trees, Seaborg said, suddenly.
Son of a bitch!
What are you thinking, Seaborg? Sagan asked. In training, Drak and I won a war game by sneaking up on the opposing side in the trees, he said. They were expecting us to attack from the ground. They never bothered looking up until we got right up to them. Then I almost fell out of the tree and nearly got myself killed, but the idea worked. The three of them turned to look at the trees inside their perimeter. They weren't real trees, but the Aristian equivalent. Large, spindly plants that reached meters high into the sky.
Tell me we're all having the same bug-shit crazy thought, Harvey said. I'd hate to think it was just me.
Come on, Sagan said. Let's see what we can do with this.
That's insane, Jared said. The Oban wouldn't start a war just because you asked them to.
Really?
Bhutan said. A sneer crept onto his face. And you know this from your vast personal knowledge of the Oban? Your years of study on the matter? You wrote your doctoral thesis on the Oban?
No species would go to war just because you asked them to, Jared said. The Oban don't do anything for anyone else.
And they're not now, Bhutan said.
The war is a means to an end. They want what I can offer them.
And what is that? Jared asked.
I can give them souls, Bhutan said.
I don't understand, Jared said.
It's because you don't know the Oban, Bhutan said.
The Oban are a created race. The Khonsu made them just to see what would happen. But despite rumors to the contrary, the Khonsu aren't perfect. They make mistakes, and they made a huge mistake when they made the Oban. They gave the Oban intelligence, but what they couldn't do, what they didn't have the capability of doing, was to give the Oban consciousness.
The Oban are conscious, Jared said.
They have a society, they communicate, they remember, they think.
So what?
Bhutan said. Termites have societies. Every species communicates.
You don't have to be intelligent to remember. You have a computer in your head that remembers everything you ever do, and it's fundamentally no more intelligent than a rock.
And as for thinking, what about thinking requires you to observe yourself doing it?
Not a goddamned thing.
You can create an entire star-faring race that has no more self-introspection than a protozoan, and the Oban are the living proof of that. The Oban are aware, collectively, that they exist. But not one of them, individually, has anything that you would recognize as a personality. No ego. No I.
That doesn't make any sense, Jared said.
Why not? Bhutan said. What are the trappings of self-awareness? And do the Oban have it? The Oban have no art, Dirac. They have no music or literature or visual arts. They comprehend the concept of art intellectually, but they have no way to appreciate it. The only time they communicate is to tell each other factual things, where they're going or what's over that hill or how many people they need to kill. They can't lie. They have no moral inhibition against it. Well, they don't actually have any real moral inhibitions against anything. But they can no more formulate a lie than you or I could levitate an object with our mind power. Our brains aren't wired that way. Their brains aren't wired that way.
Everybody lies. Everybody who is conscious, who has a self-image to maintain. But they don't. They're perfect.
Being ignorant of your own existence is not what I'd call perfect, Jared said.
They are perfect, Bhutan insisted.
They don't lie. They cooperate perfectly with each other, within the structure of their society. Challenges or disagreements are dealt with in a prescribed manner. They don't backstab. They are perfectly moral because their morals are absolute, hard-coded. They have no vanity and no ambition. They don't even have sexual vanity. They're all hermaphrodites and pass their genetic information to each other as casually as you or I would shake hands. And they have no fear.
Every creature has fear, Jared said.
Even the non-conscious ones.
No,
Bhutan said.
Every creature has a survival instinct.
It looks like fear, but it's not the same thing. Fear isn't the desire to avoid death or pain. Fear is rooted in the knowledge that what you recognize as yourself can cease to exist. Fear is existential. The Oban are not existential in the slightest. That's why they don't surrender. It's why they don't take prisoners. It's why the Colonial Union fears them, you know, because they can't be made afraid.
What an advantage that is!
It's so much of an advantage that if I'm ever in charge of creating human soldiers again, I'm going to suggest stripping out their consciousness.
Jared shuddered. Bhutan noted it. Come now, Dirac, Bhutan said.
You can't tell me that awareness has been a happy thing for you. Aware that you've been created for a purpose other than your own existence. Aware of memories of someone else's life. Aware that your purpose is nothing more than to kill the people and things the Colonial Union points you at.
You're a gun with an ego.
You'd be better off without the ego.
Horse shit, Jared said.
Bhutan smiled.
Well, fair enough, he said. I can't say I'd want to be without self-awareness either, and since you're supposed to be me, I can't say that I'm surprised you feel the same way.
If the Oban are perfect, I don't see why they would need you, Jared said.
Because they don't see themselves as perfect, of course, Bhutan said. They know they lack consciousness, and while individually it might not matter much to them, as a species it matters a great deal. They saw my work on consciousness, mostly on consciousness transference, but also my early notes on recording and storing consciousness entirely. They desired what they thought I could give them, greatly.
Have you given them consciousness? Jared asked.
Not yet, Bhutan said, but I'm getting close.
Close enough to make them desire it even more.
Desire, Jared repeated.
A strong emotion for a species who lacks sentience.
Do you know what Oban means? Bhutan asked. What the actual word means in the Oban language, when it's not being used to refer to the Oban as a species?
No, Jared said.
It means lacking,
Bhutan said, and cocked his head, bemusedly.
Isn't that interesting?
With most intelligent species, if you look back far enough for the etymological roots of what they call themselves, you'll come up with some variation or another of the people. Because every species starts off on their own little home world, convinced they are the absolute center of the universe.
Not the Oban. They knew right from the beginning what they were, and the word they used to describe themselves showed they knew that they were missing something every other intelligent species had. They lacked consciousness.
It's just about the only truly descriptive noun they have.
Well, that and Obener, which means home of those who lack. Everything else is just dry as dust.
Arist means third moon.
But Oban is remarkable. Imagine if every species named itself after its greatest flaw.
We could name our species Arrogance.
Why would knowing they lack consciousness matter to them? Jared asked.
Why did knowing that she couldn't eat from the tree of knowledge matter to Eve?
Bhutan said.
It shouldn't have mattered, but it did. She was temptable, which, if you believe in an all-powerful God, means God intentionally put temptation into Eve,
which seems like a dirty trick, if you ask me.
There's no reason the Oban should desire sentience.
It'll do them no good. But they want it anyway. I think it's possible that the Khonsu, rather than screwing up and creating an intelligence without ego, intentionally created the Oban that way, and then programmed them with the desire for the one thing they could not have.
But why?
Why do the Khonsu do anything? Bhutan said.
When you're the most advanced species around, you don't have to explain yourselves to the rock bangers, which would be us.
For our purposes, they might as well be gods,
and the Oban are the poor, insensate Adams and Eves.
So this makes you the snake, Jared said.
Bhutan smiled at the backhanded reference.
Maybe so, he said.
And maybe by giving the Oban what they want, I'll force them out of their egoless paradise. They can deal with that. In the meantime, I'll get what I want from this. I'll get my war, and I'll get the end of the colonial union.
The tree the three of them looked at stood about 10 meters high and was about a meter in diameter. The trunk was covered with ridges. In a rainfall, these could funnel water into the inner part of the tree. Every 3 meters, larger ridges sprouted a circular array of vines and delicate branches, decreasing in circumference as they increased in altitude. Sagan, Seaborg, and Harvey watched as the tree swayed in the breeze.
"That's a pretty light breeze to make the tree sway this much," Sagan said.
The wind's probably faster up there, Harvey said.
Not by that much, Sagan said. If at all, it's only 10 meters up.
Maybe it's hollow, Seaborg said. Like the trees on Phoenix,
When Dirac and I were doing our thing, we had to be careful which of the phoenix trees we walked across. Some of the smaller ones wouldn't have supported our weight.
Sagan nodded. She approached the tree and put weight on one of the smaller ridges.